Imagine a patient is rushed into the emergency department and they are suffocating, like essentially drowning in their own body fluid because their heart just isn't pumping effectively.
Right, a classic terrifying scenario.
Exactly. So the medical team, they act quickly. They give them this really powerful, life-saving intravenous diuretic. And within hours, the fluid clears from the lungs. The patient can breathe again.
Seems like a win.
Right. By all immediate metrics, it's a total clinical triumph. But, and here's the crazy part, 3 days later, that exact same patient is in a coma, and shortly after, they die.
Wow.
And it's not because the initial diagnosis was wrong, or because the medication was bad for the lungs. It's because the clinician was so incredibly focused on fixing the failing heart that they completely failed to account for the patient's already compromised kidneys.
Yeah, that tunnel vision.
Exactly. So the diuretic drastically drops the patient's blood volume, which drops the pressure to the kidneys. The kidneys fail, toxins build up in the blood, and the systemic collapse is irreversible. The exact thing that saved their lungs is literally what killed them.
It's a devastating scenario. And what is truly unsettling, honestly, is just how common that fundamental dynamic is in modern healthcare.
Right.
We see the isolated organ, we treat the isolated organ, and we remain totally blind to the living interconnected system as a whole.
Which is exactly why we are here today. Welcome to this deep dive, because today we are exploring why modern medicine is basically built to miss that big picture. And more importantly, how a totally new framework is trying to fix it.
Yeah, it's a really important topic.
For you listening at home, today we're looking at a frankly provocative medical manuscript. It's titled Internal Medicine Made Easy, A Life Coherent Guide to Clinical Reasoning, Physiology, and Healing. It's by Dr. Bichara Saley, and it's dated June 18th, 2026.
And, I have to say, the title almost feels a little ironic, right?
Oh, totally.
Because the whole mission of this text is to show that internal medicine is just, it is anything but easy.
Yeah, no kidding. And just to set the stage for you, the mission of this deep dive isn't to like hand you a medical degree today or prep you for hospital rounds. Instead, we are uncovering this really radical paradigm shift in how we view illness and healing, and honestly, the human body itself,
Yeah.
because the text argues that our current medical model is deeply flawed, mostly because it treats patients as this collection of fragmented parts, a bad liver in bed four, a pulmonary embolism in bed six.
Exactly. And that fragmentation, that is exactly where clinical reasoning starts to break down. What's fascinating here is that the manuscript insists that physiology without context is effectively blind.
Wow, why?
Again, we've built this incredibly sophisticated medical apparatus, right? And it's highly adept at finding one specific pathophysiological defect, but it just constantly fails because it ignores the environment, it ignores the patient's baseline reserve, and it ignores the deeply messy reality of the person actually housing that defect.
Okay, let's unpack this, because this brings us to the core concept of the text. It's this framework Dr. Saley calls the life coherent clinical loop.
Yes, the loop.
And usually I feel like when a medical text gives you a framework, it's just, another bureaucratic checklist, like a rigid algorithm to memorize.
Oh, absolutely. Just more paperwork.
Right. But this is really different. The text presents it as this cognitive safety net. It's this six-step recursive cycle. And it's designed to pull a doctor out of the sheer chaos of a sick patient and guide them toward true holistic repair. It's trying to bridge that massive gap between cold, microscopic data and the human experience.
Yeah. And to fully appreciate how elegant this life coherent model is, I think we first really have to grapple with the environment that makes it necessary in the first place,
It's the hospital environment.
Right. We have to look at why internal medicine feels so incredibly difficult. The text spends a lot of time sort of deconstructing the expectations of medical education versus the reality of the hospital ward.
Well, let's talk about that clash, because the source highlights how medical students basically spend years studying in biological silos. Like they study the cardiovascular block for a few weeks, then they move to the renal block, then neurology. They are deeply conditioned to expect textbook cases.
Yeah, they expect the world to be neat. They expect that pneumonia is going to walk through the clinic doors presenting exactly how it does on page 402 of their textbook. Fever, productive cough, maybe some chest pain, and a very clear spot on a chest X-ray.
A perfect picture.
Right. Or they expect a heart attack to just be that classic crushing chest pain radiating to the left arm.
Right. And the awesome acknowledges why we do this, right? The sheer volume of medical knowledge is just, insane. It requires reductionism. You literally have to break the human machine down into parts just to comprehend it. You can't learn it all at once.
No, of course not. But the danger, as the text argues, is that this educational structure fundamentally clashes with the biological reality of a living organism.
Hey.
In a human body, these systems are not in silos. They are in constant, instantaneous crosstalk.
Okay, but wait, I do have to push back on this premise just a little bit.
Sure.
Isn't that intense specialization kind of exactly what we want? I mean, if I have complex coronary artery disease, I want a cardiologist who knows literally everything about the hemodynamics of the left ventricle. I don't necessarily want a generalist for that. Is the author saying that specialization is bad?
Oh, no, not at all. The text is actually very explicit that deep, specialized knowledge is totally non-negotiable.
Okay, good.
The problem isn't the specialization itself. The problem is when that specialization becomes the end point of clinical thought, mm-hmm. instead of just being one component of it.
Ah, I see.
The author is basically arguing that specialization is necessary, but it's just not sufficient for complex care. Those separations we create for the sake of learning. They have to dissolve the second you step up to the bedside.
Because the patient isn't just a cardiology case.
Precisely. Real patients don't arrive with a single isolated textbook pathology. They arrive as complex, overlapping puzzles.
Yeah, the text uses a really good example of this with a patient presenting with pneumonia.
Right. So in the textbook, you assess the bug, you prescribe the antibiotic, and you're done. The lung is the target. But the real patient sitting in front of you with that pneumonia, they might also have chronic kidney disease, and they might be really frail. And maybe they have mild dementia.
It sounds like trying to fix a complex ecosystem by, like, only looking at the soil while completely ignoring the rain, the animals, and the temperature.
That is a brilliant analogy, yes.
Yeah.
Because when that pneumonia infection hits, it doesn't just sit in the lung. The systemic inflammation might drop their blood pressure.
Right.
Which then cuts off blood flow to the kidneys.
So now your pneumonia patient is also an acute kidney injury patient.
Exactly. And because the kidneys aren't clearing waste, those toxins build up, cross the blood-brain barrier, and suddenly that mild dementia turns into full-blown acute delirium.
Wow.
If the doctor is only looking at the lung, they write the antibiotic order and walk away. They totally miss that the patient's entire physiological ecosystem is actively collapsing.
That is so scary. And it's exactly the tension this new framework is trying to solve. So I really want to ground this in a specific scenario so you listening can truly see how Dr. Saley's life-coherent model works in practice.
Good idea. Let's build a case based on the text.
Okay, let's say we have a 79-year-old woman. She comes into the emergency department complaining of progressive shortness of breath, her ankles are visibly swollen, and she has a long history of diabetes. Now, the traditional rushed approach, that fragmented approach, would look at the shortness of breath and the swollen ankles, recognize the pattern of fluid overload, declare heart failure, give her a massive dose of diuretics, and admit her.
And that right there is exactly the kind of premature closure the manuscript is warning against.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an understandable reflex. The doctor sees a familiar pattern and jumps to the obvious fix. But the life-coherent model forces a hard stop. It demands this disciplined rhythm of clinical attention to stop that exact reflex.
Which is why it's not a straight line. The author presents it as a six-step recursive loop.
Dang.
Danger, syndrome, capacity failure, coupling conditions, wise perturbation, and repair trajectory. But if this loop is so brilliant, why isn't it just a straight line? Why a loop?
Because human biology changes constantly. If you give that 79-year-old woman the diuretic, you are fundamentally altering her body.
Right.
For the first day, that might be exactly what she needs. Her lungs clear up. But if you're using a straight line checklist, you check the box and assume she's fixed.
But she's not.
No, because the recursive loop forces you to circle back. By day three, that same diuretic might have dried her out so much that her kidneys are failing. The treatment that was wise yesterday is actively harming her today. The loop forces you to catch that.
So it forces you to adapt to your own interventions. Okay, let's walk through this loop with our 79-year-old patient, starting the second she rolls through the doors. Step one. The very first question the text says a clinician must ask isn't, what's the diagnosis?
Right.
It's assessing danger. The principle is danger first.
Yes, and the text is completely unyielding on this. The first duty is to recognize physiological danger before finalizing any diagnosis. Danger means anything that could kill, disable, or cause irreversible harm if it's missed.
The mantra is, what must not be missed.
Exactly.
You know, I find it fascinating that it prioritizes danger over diagnostic certainty, because we have this TV image of the brilliant doctor who needs to know exactly what the obscure disease is before they make a move.
Right, the House MD fantasy. But the reality of acute medicine is that absolute certainty takes time. And a crashing patient does not have time.
Yeah, waiting for blood cultures to grow takes days.
Exactly. Or trending troponin levels for a heart attack takes hours. But if a patient has a blocked airway or their blood sugar is zero, their brain cells are actively dying while you wait for the lab. You have to secure the safety of the physiology before you solve the puzzle.
So it's like being a detective at a crime scene. Before you try to figure out who the mastermind is, you first make sure the building isn't currently on fire.
That's a great way to put it.
But here's my question. Doesn't constantly looking for the absolute worst case scenario lead to just like a massive overtesting? If a healthy 20-year-old comes in with a cough, are we doing a full body MRI to rule out cancer? Doesn't this cause medical anxiety?
That is a very valid critique, but the text is careful here.
Hit.
It explicitly states that danger first is not panic.
Okay.
It's an organized screen. It references the classic primary survey assessing airway, breathing, circulation, disability, exposure, glucose. It's about ruling out the immediate time-critical risks based on the vital signs and the presentation right in front of you, not scanning every single patient for every rare disease.
That makes sense. And the manuscript provides these incredible case studies where massive danger hides behind really reassuring, dismissible labels.
Oh, the cases are chilling.
Let's look at the just anxiety case. The text describes a 31-year-old woman who comes in with sudden chest tightness, shortness of breath, and a feeling of impending doom. And she has a documented history of panic attacks in her chart.
Right. The path of least resistance for a tired doctor is to see that history, say, it's just anxiety, maybe give her a mild sedative and send her home.
And the text argues that is a potentially lethal cognitive error.
Lethal. Because danger first reasoning forces you to actively suspend that assumption. Even with a history of panic disorder, sudden shortness of breath must trigger a search for life-threatening things.
Like what?
Like a pulmonary embolism. A massive blood clot in the lung drops arterial oxygen and strains the right side of the heart. Biologically, that presents almost identically to a severe panic attack. The patient feels like they are suffocating because at a cellular level, they actually are.
Wow, if you anchor on the psychiatric label, you miss the blood clot and they could die.
Exactly.
Another one is the just dementia scenario. An 86-year-old man with Alzheimer's is brought in because he's suddenly way more confused. Again, the trap is right there. The doctor thinks, well, he has dementia. He's just getting worse.
But the Life Coherent model says acute confusion is never just baseline dementia. Dementia is slow. A sudden spike in confusion is a glaring alarm bell for a new biological insult.
Like an infection.
Right, like a UTI or hypoxia from a silent pneumonia. Or even a new medication that's messing with his brain chemistry. The dementia just makes his brain more fragile. It doesn't explain the sudden change. You have to look for the danger.
And the third danger example totally reframed hospital logistics for me. The danger of discharge. Imagine an 89-year-old woman treated for pneumonia, no fever, normal oxygen. The chart says she is medically fit for discharge.
Yes, the infections are gone. The hospital thinks its job is done.
But the text says discharging her could be a profound danger. If she's been weakened by a week in bed, if she's slightly delirious, if she can't walk to the bathroom, and she lives alone on the second floor, sending her home is an unsafe clinical act. Unsafe discharge is a danger.
Because physiological stability does not equal real-world safety.
Exactly. Okay, so once the clinician ensures the building isn't on fire, they have to organize the clues, which leads to step two, from symptoms to syndromes.
Right, because patients don't walk in and hand you a diagnosis. They don't say, my left ventricle is failing. They give you raw, subjective symptoms. I can't catch my breath.
And you can't just treat tiredness or breathlessness, because fatigue could be depression, or it could be severe anemia where they have no hemoglobin, or it could be a thyroid issue.
The symptom alone is diagnostically useless. You have to translate it into a syndrome, a recognizable clinical pattern.
How does the text define the difference?
Well, the text uses the example of shortness of breath. That's a symptom. The syndrome would be progressive dyspnea over 2 weeks with edema, orthopnea, meaning she can't breathe lying flat and reduced urine output in a patient with chronic kidney disease.
Okay, let's unpack this. Isn't a syndrome just a fancier, longer name for the same thing? Why not just skip straight to diagnosing her with heart failure?
Because jumping to the diagnosis closes your mind. The syndrome acts as a cognitive buffer. It forces you to organize the differential diagnosis. It asks, what is likely? What is dangerous? What is treatable? It keeps your mind open just long enough to consider, wait, could this fluid overload actually be her kidneys failing entirely instead of her heart? It prevents premature closure.
Got it. Okay, so now we have a pattern. And this leads us to step three, which I think is the most profound pivot in the whole book. Capacity failure. The framework demands we stop looking at the disease label and start treating the person.
Yes. This is the heart of life-coherent medicine. A label like diabetes is an abstraction. Capacity failure asks a totally different question. What can this patient no longer sustain?
The text has this capacity systems map. It says internal medicine shouldn't just look at organs, but life functions, oxygenation, circulation, clearance of waste. But it also includes things like cognition, mobility, comfort, agency, and dignity.
Right. And to really see this, look at the two pneumonia patients from the text. Patient A and patient B both have the exact same disease label, community-acquired pneumonia, the same bacteria.
But the clinical reality is totally different.
Exactly. Patient A is 55. They have a cough and fever, but they're sitting up, eating, talking, breathing fine on room air. Their physiological reserve is intact.
But patient B is an 82-year-old with pre-existing lung disease.
Yes. The same bacteria causes a catastrophic cascade for patient B. Failing oxygenation, they're deeply hypoxic. That causes failing cognition, they're delirious, thrashing in bed, which causes failing mobility.
If the doctor just looks at the label, they give both patients an antibiotic and feel like they did their job. But the antibiotic just fights the bug. It doesn't restore the failing capacities right now.
Right. If you connect this to the bigger picture, treating the capacity failure means recognizing patient B needs massive support just to survive the next 2 days. They need oxygen, delirium management, physical therapy. The disease is the same. The capacity failure dictates the actual medical care.
This completely flips how we think about getting sick. We usually think, I caught a bug, but this is saying my body's capacity to regulate its energy and defend itself is currently collapsing. It's the difference between knowing a storm is called a hurricane versus knowing exactly which windows in your house are breaking.
That is exactly it. And I love that the map includes agency and dignity as clinical capacities.
Right. I wanted to ask about that. We usually think of dignity as just like bedside manner. How is it a clinical capacity?
An illness or the medical system itself threatens dignity through things like agonizing, uncontrolled pain, or leaving a patient soiled because the ward is short-staffed. Or just rushed communication, it strips them of their humanity.
And agency.
Agency is lost when a patient is delirious, sure. But it's also lost when a doctor hands them a ridiculously complex treatment plan they don't understand and doesn't check if they can actually do it. If they can't participate in their care, their agency has failed. And it's the doctor's job to restore it, just like fixing a dropping blood pressure.
That is so powerful. But sometimes, even when we give the right medicine for the capacity failure, the patient doesn't get better. Or they go home and bounce right back into the ER a week later. Why?
Because of step four, structural coupling. Patients don't live in a vacuum.
Illness persists when the conditions that sustain it remain unchanged.
Precisely. Structural coupling means a patient's biological illness is permanently interacting with their environment, their finances, their housing, their health literacy, their sleep. Social issues aren't non-medical extras. They're critical clinical data.
Let's use the uncontrolled diabetes case from the text. A 59-year-old man whose blood sugar is dangerously high. The narrow, fragmented view blames him for being non-compliant. They might lecture him and just up his insulin dose.
But the coupling view asks the real questions. Can he afford that expensive insulin? Does he have a fridge to store it? The text reveals he works erratic night shifts at a warehouse, lives in a food desert eating cheap processed food, and is terrified of accidentally overdosing on insulin while he sleeps alone, so he underdoses on purpose.
His high blood sugar is perfectly coupled to his poverty, his schedule, and his fear.
Yes.
If the doctor just writes a prescription for a higher dose, they are prescribing a treatment to an environment that cannot absorb it.
Exactly. Or the persistent delirium case in the ICU. An older patient's infection is cured, but they're still confused and agitated. Why?
Because the ICU room is loud, the lights are glaring, they're tied down by a catheter, and they don't have their hearing aids.
You can't cure that with a pill. You have to uncouple them from the toxic environment, give them their hearing aids, turn off the lights.
This makes total sense, but, and I have to ask this, it also sounds completely overwhelming for a doctor. Where does a doctor's job end and a social worker's job begin? A primary care doctor has 15 minutes. They can't buy the patient a fridge.
The author acknowledges this with a concept called clinical humility. The doctor can't fix the whole socioeconomic system, but prescribing a medication the patient absolutely cannot take or afford is fundamentally an unsafe clinical plan. The plan must fit the coupling conditions or it will fail.
So you have to adapt, even if it means prescribing an older, slightly less optimal drug that they can actually afford.
Exactly. A perfect biological plan they can't execute is the same as no plan at all.
Which brings us perfectly to the next step. If we know the patient's capacities and their context, how do we actually intervene without making things worse? Step 5. Wise perturbation.
In this model, every treatment is viewed as a perturbation, an action introduced into a living system that will cause ripples. Treatment isn't just helping. It inherently involves harm.
Doing something is easy. Doing the right thing with the least harm is the art. What makes a perturbation wise?
It must be indicated, proportionate, feasible, monitorable, and adjustable.
Here's where it gets really interesting. I kind of equate this to playing a massive game of Jenga.
Oh, I like that.
You pull a block out to stabilize the top, say, giving a diuretic to clear the fluid from the lungs of our 79-year-old patient, but you accidentally destabilize the bottom, wrecking her kidneys. Every move has a consequence.
The Jenga analogy is perfect. Take fluids, for example. 4V fluids can save a patient in shock, but they can drown the lungs of a patient in heart failure. Or sedatives, they can calm an agitated patient, but they worsen delirium and cause falls.
Even hospital admission is a massive perturbation. Yes, you get monitoring, but you expose an elderly patient to hospital infections, sleep disruption, and muscle loss from lying in bed.
Even not acting watchful waiting is a perturbation. And the text says it's only wise if strict safety netting is in place. You can't just send them home and hope. They need to know exactly what danger signs to watch for.
The text has a great rule here. Treatment without monitoring is unfinished care. You have to watch the Jenga tower after you make your move.
You must monitor the ripples.
So you've made your move. You've given the treatment. How do you know if you actually won the game? This is the final step. Step 6, repair trajectory.
And this requires a huge cognitive shift. Healing is not just a return to normal lab numbers.
Right. If a patient's fever is gone and their white blood cell count is totally normal, but they're still delirious, terrified, and can't walk, repair has not occurred.
The numbers are better, but the human being is not. The text emphasizes that healing means the patient becomes safer, clearer, stronger, and more able to participate in life.
And the definition of repair changes depending on the context, right?
Totally. In a healthy 25-year-old, repair means returning to 100% baseline function. But in frailty, like our 79-year-old, repair might just mean getting her fluid balance steady enough so she can walk to her mailbox safely with support. You can't reverse her chronic disease.
And at the end of life.
At the end of life, repair doesn't mean cure. It means comfort, dignity, symptom relief, and peace for the family. It's aggressively treating the capacity failures that cause suffering, like pain or breathlessness.
I want to pause here and just talk to you, the listener. Think about your last doctor's visit. Did you and your doctor talk about what better would actually look like for your life, like getting back to gardening or sleeping through the night? Or did you just talk about getting your blood pressure under a certain abstract number?
This raises an important question about how we communicate. The text suggests doctors need to explain treatments using capacity language.
Give me an example. How should they talk to our 79-year-old patient?
Instead of saying, "You have an exacerbation of heart failure and need furosemide," you say, "Your heart isn't moving fluid well, so it's backing up into your lungs. Our goal is to remove that fluid so you can walk to the mailbox again without ruining your kidney salts. And we'll monitor your blood every day to keep it balanced."
Wow. That completely demystifies it. It respects their agency. So, bringing it all together, Dr. Sahili's manuscript shows that internal medicine isn't just biological mechanics. It's this profound responsibility to protect a whole living person. This loop danger, syndrome, capacity, coupling, perturbation, repair. It's a masterclass in human-centered science.
It really is. It gives structure to compassion.
And whether you're a medical professional, a caregiver, or just someone navigating your own health, this framework gives you better questions to ask. What is my capacity right now? What are the coupling conditions of my life?
Right.
I want to leave you with a final thought to ponder. If health is not just the absence of a disease label, but the presence of life capacities like agency, dignity, and participation, how much of our global healthcare budget is currently being wasted. We spend billions treating abstract numbers with expensive drugs while entirely ignoring the poverty or the environment the patient has to return to. Does our modern medical system actually care about repair, or is it just built for highly profitable perturbation?
That is the million-dollar question.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into Dr. Sahili's work. We hope it changes how you see medicine and how you advocate for yourself.